This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Bruce Kazanoff, who's sitting in for John Wells this morning. Well, we all, from time to time, witness, either in ourselves or others, a seeming lapse in judgment. Now, usually it's fleeting, but there are certain lapses that are more enduring, and conditions like mental illness, poverty, substance addiction or abuse, and even privilege can sometimes shroud our rational decision-making. Our guest, Dr. Kelly Lambert, describes our brain's ability to make contingency calculations, which predict the outcome of decisions and actions, and she has researched what goes awry when the brain's information systems are compromised and how we can lose the ability to arrive at informed decisions. She presents her work in a new book called Well-Grounded, The Neurobiology of Rational Decisions. Dr. Kelly Lambert, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Nice to have you.
Nice to be here, Lynn. Thank you.
Well, you know, of particular interest in this listing of certain types of conditions that can leave us vulnerable to not making rational decisions is one called privilege. I found that interesting and wanted to maybe start there.
Yeah, that is kind of counterintuitive when we think of having a sophisticated brain. But I like to go back to the basics. And when you think about what brains do, certainly they keep us alive with our glandular secretions and heart working, cardiovascular activity and such. But above and beyond keeping us breathing and consciously aware, especially humans, mammals, but especially humans have a really enhanced cortical, kind of above those core areas of the brain that allow us to process information. So making decisions is also incredibly important for our survival. And if you think about the importance of information and making decisions, anything that distorts that information, that can spell trouble. That can be trouble for us. So if I use this analogy of like the real estate bubbles, when information is distorted or the value is inflated in the real estate market, and there's this bubble, then we make bad decisions and we invest our resources in places we shouldn't. And so I kind of use that analogy with the brain, that we can create brain bubbles if we get into a situation where reality is consistently distorted. So privilege doesn't always mean that, but if privilege is associated with only seeing the world a certain way or interpreting it a certain way or thinking that we're doing something that we're not, if we have yes people around us saying, oh, yeah, you're great, you're great, you're great, and we don't have a good measure of what we're doing, a more realistic measure, that's going to get us in trouble because our brain's success is dependent on the accuracy of the information that it takes into the neurons, all those billions of cells to try to calculate, like recalculating, so that we can make an informed decision. So privilege could lead to that, or poverty can certainly distort what's going on in the brain and how we're interpreting that, psychoactive drugs, certain persuasions, religion, or political, that is kind of just distorting the information. So anything we can do to keep it more authentic, to keep it real, is better for the brain, just like pure air is better than polluted air.
Yeah. Well, that all makes a lot of good sense. And tell me, when I think about my own inability to make decisions, it usually happens when I go out to eat and I'm looking at this menu.
Those menus are crazy, aren't they?
It all looks good. And I think, oh, if I choose the wrong thing, I'm going to want what my, you know, my friends or family are having. And so talk about I mean,
speaking of privilege, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I suspect that may be a little bit different sort of, impediment to decision making than this, what you talk about, this contingency calculation that may disable us from making really, really important rational decisions.
Right. I mean, every decision can be important, and a decision about what we eat, that's important to us at the moment. But I try to make the argument for our backstory or the experiences that we have create and build our contingency capital or investments or stockpiles. So the more experience you have with food, or that restaurant, we like to ask sometimes the waiters, waitresses, what do you recommend? We're trying to get that, you know, pure, more authentic information. You know, it certainly fits. That's a good example, menus. The more we know, the more informed decision we can make. But certainly some decisions may have a larger kind of consequence, who to marry, what job to take, and things like that.
So, Kelly, this is Bruce.
Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I was fascinated. You talked about the Iowa gambling task and how it shed light on the ways that we could navigate uncertainty and build what you call cognitive capital. Can you explain what the task is and what that means, build cognitive capital in this context?
Yeah, well, I used it as an example to kind of, for an unexpected way to build this capital and how kind of tricky and interesting ways our brains can work. So the Iowa gambling task or variations of these tasks, where we're asking subjects, or even in some versions, the rat. I work in the world of the rat. You have some, like, two stacks of cards, and they have different payoff strategies or payoffs. So one may have a high risk, but the payoff is more, and the other may be low risk. And what our brain's trying to do is look in the long term, what is the best investment? Maybe in the long term, after you kind of flip some of these cards and you're seeing you don't know what the payoffs are, but you're trying to figure that out. So if the best payoff is this lower risk, even though you get smaller amounts of money, but you don't lose it as readily, that's what our brain is trying to calculate. It's a perfect example of contingency calculations. And I brought it up because it's interesting that some people with traumatic brain injury, maybe injury to the frontal lobe or prefrontal cortex that's involved in more executive decision-making, they have problems with these decisions. And even in normal or non-individuals who don't have this brain damage, they'll start to make the best decisions. They seem like they're on the right track. Yeah, you're going with the higher payoff pile stack. And when asked to articulate, why are you doing this, they don't, when they start doing it, they can't really articulate, oh, I've calculated this, or this is doing this. But they have the sense that it's paying off. And we can actually get some information that we're not really consciously aware of. Maybe we have this saying about gut, we had a gut feeling. We literally have, a nerve, the vagus nerve that goes down to the stomach that is processing, you know, responses. And our body is responding to, oh, this seems to be working, before we're actually consciously aware of what exactly is working. And finally, the brain kind of comes online and says, oh, yeah. I have, now that I've had some experience with this, this is the pile, this is the stack that's going to pay off. So that's just an interesting case of, you know, how are you making decisions? How are you looking at what is going to pay off in the long term, not just the short term, and what some of the brain areas that are involved, that executive functioning area, and reaching deep down and really having a gut feeling, some kind of lower processes other than those prefrontal cortex areas are catching on maybe. Right. To this earlier than even our brains are, which is so counterintuitive because we think our brains are just, you know, it's all about our brains.
Well, it sounds like you're talking about intuition is what the test is picking up on.
That would be one interpretation where you can't really articulate, so you say, I have this, yes, intuition, but I guess I'm arguing that intuition isn't just dropping, it's not just dropping from the sky. It still is coming from experience, and your nervous system is still processing it, but you're going to say intuition when you can't articulate exactly why.
Well,
I
just want to follow up on this because this is fascinating to me. People talk about what intuition is, and what got out of your book is in that test that there is substance underneath this gut feeling. That is, that people are observing that it's starting to reel, but they're conscious, you know, they would not say, oh, I figured this out, and yet they're starting to make the correct decisions. So wouldn't that argue that intuition is just something that's operating, it's based in substance in that case, but it's operating at a lower level than we're aware of?
Absolutely, yeah. That's what I was trying to convey. It's still, our nervous system is processing it, but it's acting faster than we're able to keep up with it. So intuition, it's not something mystical or, you know, it is still part of our nervous system's ability to keep track of what's going on in the world around us so that we can respond in the most adaptive way. So it's a real thing, this gut feeling or intuition.
So one other thing you talked about was one of my favorite authors, Carol Dweck, who wrote Mindset.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
At Stanford. And she says that having a growth mindset can make us more successful in life. And the question I had was, is this a potential antidote that is a growth mindset to what you call cognitive contingencies?
I think the growth mindset is just a perfect example that reflects the importance of keeping those channels open for the brain to continuously update the contingencies. Knowing that as we increase our experiences, we're going to increase our, her research was with students, younger students, and their math ability was one of her famous studies, teaching them that their brains continually update. So the more time they put in and train their brains, they're going to be able to change their behavior and output. So you're going to be fine-tuning and upgrading those contingency calculators. But if you think that, you know, now we know that our brain changes every day of our lives. We're producing new cells, and they're making these new connections, and that enhances our accountability for our brains. We're not just born with the brain, you know, that we're going to have for the rest of our lives that we inherited from our parents. And this is very hopeful, and it gives us all hope, and it's inspirational, I think, that if we do the right things with our brains, we can really optimize our ability for our brains to upgrade and to make changes and to be flexible, to not only respond one way. If responding a certain way isn't working, we need to adapt to that and to adapt and change. And our brain is all about that. We have more cells in this outer area of the cortex than any other animal. We're just kind of off the charts. Our brains still are, you know, an appropriate continuation of all the other mammalian brains. But we've managed to pack more of these neurons in that cerebral cortex that allows us to be more flexible. And more fundamental work with my rats, when I profile passive, active, and flexible copers, those flexible copers have a more manageable stress response, and they just seem to be healthy, emotionally healthier, because they can make decisions in real time, and they're not reflexive and always responding one way, regardless of whether or not it works. So I think her work really supports this idea of we need to build the contingency capital. We need to be mindful of how our experiences change our brain, and our brains can change in response to a challenge. So, very hopeful work.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Kelly Lambert. She's the author of a book called Well-Grounded, The Neurobiology of Rational Decisions. And I'm wondering, Kelly, a little bit about kind of like reverse engineering or reverse diagnosis. We all, and I'm sure you're this way, you've been a professor of behavioral neuroscience at the University of Richmond for many, many years, which means that you're in contact with lots of people, students, and, you know, when you see those people who continuously make erroneous decisions and decisions that you just wonder, where's your decision-making capability or lack thereof coming from? Can it be, and do you find yourself diagnosing some sort of either mental illness, you know, addiction, like you say, or the inability to make good decisions based on some other things that are going on in their lives?
Right. Well, I always want to look at what my students' backstories are, you know, what brought you to this point, and they have such fascinating lives that I'm always have them write a little bio to tell me about themselves and what led their brain to this particular case or point in their lives. I try to be optimistic. I've been very fortunate to work with these young college students, and their brains are more are more plastic than mine at this point, and tell them that, you know, I don't know of a disorder where a brain has just stopped, you know, once they're developed as adults, that it's not changing at all. So there's hope. So we want to teach them to be accountable and very vigilant about what they're doing with their brain. So if they're continuing to make the same mistake, maybe it's just a case of not being very reflective. Sometimes we're more up to date on everybody else's lives and analyzing that than our own self-reflection. Sometimes it's not we don't enjoy doing that sometimes. So I do try to get encourage the students to reflect on how their behavior and the environments they put their brains in influence their decisions. Certainly, many psychiatric disorders, such as depression, you know, that's going to influence. That's a bubble.
Yeah.
It's going to influence the interpretation of events in a negative way. So if that is coming up, as we, in many of my classes, we study these disorders, so students are kind of, they may identify with these symptoms. And I'm not a clinician, and I'm very careful to not diagnose the student and to send them along to someone who does, but I introduce them to the literature and what the criteria for disorder would be and what we know about it. And sometimes labels may not be that helpful. We're all kind of on this continuum of normalcy to maybe not so normal and have tipping points. And we just talk about the behavior from that perspective. So I hope that I make, through my writing and teaching, I want to make people more aware of how, if we're accountable of our brains, we can keep them healthier longer, and we can change them, not to give up and not to put ourselves in the situation where we think that we can't change it and we don't put ourselves out there. I mean, we're not going to be a great athlete, very strong or flexible or whatever game that we're playing if we don't practice. You know, our muscles are going to atrophy, and our brain will too. It's just a physiological organ, and it needs activity to know how to create these circuits and you know, what to prune and what to develop. It's a garden that always needs tending.
Yeah, that's
Never done.
That's a great metaphor, really. And really, the more we know about the malleability and the plasticity of our brain and the fact that we can do activities with it that are going to make those pathways more clear and, as you say, pruning out the stuff we don't need. So let's take, I mean, it is kind of funny, my simple example of not being able to, you know, choose a menu item when you go out to
dinner. I always use that as an example. And I notice how long people take kind of at the restaurant.
And so, you know, give us some practical tips on how, you know, those of us, and we all have different decision-making capability in different areas of our lives, and sometimes we feel, you know, sort of hampered by our lack of ability. Give us a few, you know, quick little skills that we might take throughout our day, even to be more self-reflective, as you say.
Oh, you know, there's so many skills on so many levels. So, yeah, starting with being, you know, self-diagnostic, not where we're diagnosing ourselves with psychiatric illness or something like that, but what is working and what is not? Just this response-outcome association that I talk about in the book. So when I ask this person out, or when I apply for this type of job and it never, ever, ever works, how can I change the behavior so I get the outcome that I want? So that we're not repeating, and I talk about a lizard that it sees itself in the mirror and it just keeps, you know, jumping into the mirror to attack itself, and it's not changing its behavior. We don't have a reptile brain. We have a mammalian brain, and it has all the circuits to change, but we have to be aware of those outcomes, you know, the outcomes. So enhanced awareness and reflectiveness of what is working and what isn't, and then appreciating that we can change. For depression, one of the most effective therapies, I think, is this behavioral activation therapy, where you're looking at, okay, what is not working in my life? What is making me sad and bringing me down and maybe related to this depression, although there can be many, many factors? If I'm not happy about not having a job, then what am I doing to try to change that? Am I updating my resume? Am I networking? Am I getting out of the house? Am I getting out of the bed? That we're never going to change the outcome of our job situation unless we change some of these behaviors. And we live in a very different world than our ancestors who evolved these brains lived in. And, you know, I talk and I wonder and I worry about this culture that we live in where we're less physically active. And, you know, I'm guilty. I'm sitting here looking at my screen. I'll sit here for a long time today, and I'm not moving my body. And even though I'm working on what I think are kind of, you know, cerebral intellectual activities, my cortex is just a small part of my brain. Most of my brain evolved to move us around. So we have this thing hanging off the back of our brain called the cerebellum that has 70%+ of all the brain cells, the neurons in our brains, and that's involved in motor coordination, simplistically, and some other things. And we have this huge part of the middle of our brain that's involved in movement, and the motor cortex, you know, involving our hands and moving our body. So if you look at real estate, I started talking about real estate bubbles, but if you look at the real estate of our brain, kind of become a brain whisperer and let it tell us what is important, movement and physical effort is important. That was important for our ancestors. I don't think they had couch potatoes in the cave. If you didn't get out, you didn't get.
You died.
You didn't live. So being active, interspersing some physical activity into our day if we can. I call this effort-based rewards. It may be simple, like cooking, cleaning house, gardening, woodworking, or something where we can see the direct impact of our physical effort and the outcome. Ooh, I moved my hands and I carved something I like, or I chopped up these vegetables, sauteed them, and this was a dinner I like. So this is kind of a mental health supplement, like a vitamin supplement. It doesn't replace the food we eat, but this can remind us, even if we have this incredibly complex, sophisticated life with all this, the digital devices and these, very advanced thought processes going on, our brain still needs to see that it has some effect in the world. So having those hobbies that are kind of physical, they produce something that we appreciate and value. Those are good mental health vitamins as well. And just to increase the amount of knowledge that we have, if we're making decisions in this fast-paced, world with information. I talk about the importance of understanding even statistics and how things work, that our brain gets kind of tripped up on some illusions and things that seem to be good. But if we learn more about it and educate that brain and have more information for our circuits to work with, that's going to enhance the sophistication of our thought processes and decision-making.
Kelly,
easy. There's not a magic bullet, but there are different layers of things that can keep our brain healthy so that it's not falling into this, routine of making bad decisions.
Can I ask you about a different type of exercise? You wrote about Jay Leno and how he used comedy contingency circuits when he was on The Tonight Show for the first time. Can you tell us what that means and
so
just explain what happened?
So I thought that he was an important case study that people could identify with, older people like me, because he writes in his autobiography that even when he was at the pinnacle, at the Tonight Show, that's the highest you go with being a comedian, he would still go to these local comedy clubs, there's one that I talk about there, to test out his material, to actually see what the outcome is. So that's brilliant. That's very smart to know what the consequences, the outcomes are before you're, testing it out on a national audience. So he seems to be an example who was not, he didn't develop these brain bubbles. Arrogance or privilege did not tell his brain that, it doesn't matter what joke you tell, it's going to be funny. He continuously tested it with these smaller audiences, and he still does today. And I also talk about his hobby of being a mechanic, and that the action outcome of I'm changing this whatever in the car, and now the car works, works more smoothly. So he's supplementing those contingency circuits, reminding his brain in a healthy way that it has some impact, and then more specific for his job. He's testing the waters on the outcomes of the jokes. And he also writes about, being very vigilant about the audience. Some jokes are going to be more appropriate for the audience and reading the audience. And you may have been referring to his first kind of when he was a guest.
Right, the most pressurized moment in any man's career if you're in comedy, a woman's career.
Yeah. And so he gave a joke, he told a joke that didn't seem to, or he had a heckler in the audience, but he knew how to, his experience of reading the audience made him more responsive and flexible. He had another tool to pull out.
Well, you wrote about how he there was a heckler, which never happens on The Tonight Show, and so he had to adapt midstream on The Tonight Show in
right.
his first
yeah,
appearance.
Yeah, exactly. So the heckler, I mean, that's the worst case. You know, the worst case scenario, you would think they don't laugh, but he's got a heckler. And so he had, again, his capital, his experience, his stockpiles of telling these jokes and working with audiences and noticing the audience and being able to respond in real time, it gave him more of a repertoire to pull from. So he was able to pull that heckler and make a joke, some joke about Telly Savalas or, you know, about being a police on TV or something. And he got a laugh. And so he was called by Johnny to come and talk. And that meant that he was a hit, that he approved. But being able to respond in that real time, being a flexible coper or thinker, that just doesn't happen. That's based on his experience and what he has gained from other experiences and knowing what to do. So I think on many levels, he's a good example of not creating those bubbles and not being distorted and being able to respond in real time in a more authentic way.
Yeah. Dr. Kelly Lambert is our guest, and the book is called Well Grounded, The Neurobiology of Rational Decisions. Kelly, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio. Really interesting.
It's been fun being here. Thank you.